Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. I've got senior consultant Rob Burtman joining me for today's show. What's going on, Rob?
Hey, Travis. Doing okay. How about you?
I'm doing okay. I will admit that I'm extremely distracted right now. I'm wearing a blue and yellow shirt in honor of Ukraine and the patriotic forces facing down pure evil over there. So I'm very distracted by that. Very much my thoughts are over there. You know the story, Rob, but I think our listeners probably don't. I retired from my job at 25 when I was a bond trader because I thought I knew everything. And I traveled the world, went to 40 countries. One of the things that I did was just sort of go to random countries in Eastern Europe all over the place. And it was so much fun. And I got to Ukraine. I loved it so much. The people were so nice. People were just so open to share things. People would just come up to me and they were just genuinely good people, like offering to be a tour guide in the museum. And I was expecting, you know, to get ripped off and they were going to ask me for $20 or something. Rob, they asked me for 25 cents.
Wow.
25 cents. And I was just like, is that a joke? You're really doing that for such a low price? And it wasn't just that. I mean, I don't want to sound like it was all about the low prices or something. It was just because the people just, you could tell I was there right after the Maidan Revolution happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I could just see just the passion in their eyes, just like how exciting it was for all these people to be free and living in a free country, free from fear. And it was just so cool. And then to see many of these same places get bombed on television is pretty surreal. So I know this is not the Ukrainian conflict podcast, right? There's plenty of episodes out there about that, but that's just sort of what's on my mind. And I've been very distracted from doing what we're supposed to be doing, talking about student loans lately.
Well, you have personal connections there too. I mean, you're still in touch with some of the people that you met over there and you've heard what they're going through from a personal level. So it's got to be even more emotionally taxing just to hear what's going on.
One thing that I never really thought about before becoming a business owner is just like the feeling of accountability for your people and the feeling of caring for your people on your team. One of our top developers for this site is Ukrainian, and he's in Ukraine right now.
Wow.
We're working on a project together before the invasion. I was concerned about him. I said, hey, could you maybe consider leaving the country? You know, I said, you know, are you considering it? Like, we would help if you felt like that was needed. And he said, I don't think anything's going to happen. He goes dark for a few days after the invasion. I'm super worried about him. And then he sends me this message. Hey, just wanted to let you know I'm going to try to upload a couple more lines of code.
Oh, jeez.
And he goes, we've been under rocket attack the past couple nights, but we've got internet for the next couple hours. So I was going to finish up the project and we'll probably lose signal again. And I was like, are you kidding? Like, are you serious right now? You're worried about like some project you're working on for us? Take care of yourself. Like, stay safe, please, you know?
Yeah, that's an amazing show of hard work, of patriotism, that's incredible to hear. I mean, that's, wow.
This morning, he sent me another message. The defense forces are fighting, I'm quoting him, the defense forces are fighting near my city now. I believe we will stay strong and we will not let them get into Mykolaiv. Thank you for your help. Wow. You know, it's heavy stuff. So I think we're going to switch a little bit for the pod today and just talk about something a little bit lighter. And it's a good thing to talk about to distract us from what's going on in the world right now. So we'll put it that way. We're going to talk about interest rate policy. I do want to come back to Ukraine just because I do think it's just so intense what's going on right now. And it does actually have a lot of implications for what we're going to talk about today, which is interest rate policy and what's going on with interest rates. So there is a tie-in, and I want to talk about it a little bit more at the end of the show, but let's talk about interest rates. So, Rob, I did decide to show up at a neighborhood party I was invited to this weekend, which is like one of the first ones I've gotten an invite to in a while with COVID and this area where I live being, you know, a little bit more cautious about those kind of things. We met this new couple to the neighborhood and they had just bought a house. I don't know how, I mean, this is just me being a weirdo, I guess, but somehow what their interest rate was on their mortgage came up in conversation.
I'm not surprised.
I'm not a very good party companion. I was just sort of curious. I was like, you know, so when did you get your rate lock? When did you apply? And they said, oh, like November. It's like, oh, so it's probably like 3-something. And they're like, yeah, 3.1. And I said, well, did you know that as we're sitting here now, the 30-year average mortgage interest rate now is 4% instead of 3. And they're like, what? They were talking about like how they had just spent all of their money like buying this house because they felt like if they didn't, they were just never going to be able to afford a house,
mm-hmm.
which is like some of that psychological dangerous thinking that happens when you have asset bubbles, right, at the start of it or near the end of it too. Anyways, I looked at what their mortgage payment would have been, because you can tell what they paid on Zillow, right? I'm just going to admit that I looked.
Again, not surprised.
Yeah, so you can tell what their mortgage payment would be at a 4% versus a 3.
Mm-hmm.
And so say you've got like a $700,000 house with a 4% mortgage versus a 3% mortgage. The payment with the 4% mortgage was $3,340 a month. And then with a 3% mortgage was $2,950. So basically $400 a month.
And that's all interest.
Yeah, all interest. So $4,800 a year, all interest. And a whole lot of people don't even itemize their mortgage, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I guess with the standard deduction being $12,000, I think it is now, Rob, why would somebody, what would a typical middle-class family not itemize their mortgage?
Well, if they're married, it's around $25,000 even. And so people, I say, oh, buy a house because of the, you get the tax deduction. Well, it's only incremental if you can meet the $12,000-ish for an individual or the $25,000 for a couple. You know, if your deductions are $30,000, you're only getting a benefit on like only some of that. But that's a huge difference. I mean, a lot of people buy, you know, I know you always advise, you know, keep the home purchase to 2x household income. But a lot of people don't do that. You know, a lot of people, they look at the monthly payment. What monthly payment can I afford? And they're willing to buy prices, spend $50,000, $100,000 more than maybe they should because the payment works. And that's fine to an extent, but you know, now you're seeing that has a dramatic impact on what people can actually afford, what they feel like they can afford.
Well, it's a 15% difference in the payment.
Right.
And so the real fear here is there something that's going to cause the housing market to have people hit the brakes? I mean, because mm-hmm. a 15% higher payment, can people just afford that? I guess maybe some people, but like you said, incremental deductions. So mortgage interest, if you've got a $700,000 mortgage, your interest is probably right at that $25,000 level, you know, mm-hmm. annually. And so you might have $10,000 worth of state and property taxes, but the deduction there is now capped because the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act and the 2017 tax law, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you're not even getting to deduct the mortgage because you would have gotten to deduct the standard deduction. So all you're getting to do is to take that $10,000 that's, you know, that property tax deduction, and that's it. So in other words, that $4,800 a month, or $4,800 a year. Huh, thank goodness it's not a month. The $4,800 a month is something that luckily they didn't have to incur, but it would have been after tax dollars.
Right. They got sort of a bargain, I guess, if you look at it that way. You know, but that being said, I think rates going up and mortgage rates going up, at least people are starting to have to think about what they can do and what they can afford. You know, when things are going down, it's always, oh, let's go more, more, more. And people are fine with it until rates start to creep back up and they feel like they missed out. But rates are still historically cheap. You know, like my father-in-law used to joke around. He's like, I thought I was a genius when I got, you know, 9.75% on my mortgage rate 40 or 50 years ago. So in perspective, interest rates are still really low, but that has a huge tangible difference if you've been looking at buying a house over the last couple of years, but you haven't done it yet.
Yeah. I mean, from what I can tell, the price of housing stayed somewhat stable so far.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's the real question mark is if interest rates stay high and if they even keep going higher, something's got to give. Like your average housing payment per $1,000 of mortgage, if it goes up compared to what it was this past summer, if it goes up to 20-30% higher, well, consumers can't just magically swing that.
No, not for this big of a piece of their expenses.
Right. And at some point, your retirees and near retirees start getting nervous about all this housing equity that they've seen go up. And they start thinking, oh man, maybe I need to go ahead and get my house, hurry up and get this thing listed to make sure that I don't miss out on this situation that's just like nothing I've ever seen before.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I'm starting to see a few more houses for sale in our neighborhood than I feel like we have. And so that's going to be a big test for the economy, I think, this spring, this summer, is with interest rates being a little bit higher, assuming they stay a little higher, what's going to happen with like housing supply being maybe a little bit more normal than it would be normally. Also just interest rates causing payments to be a little bit higher than they would be normally. And that might cool housing demand a little bit, which I would probably say for the economy overall, I don't know what you think, Rob, is probably a good thing to try to give people a little bit more shot at buying houses in a normal market.
I think we need to have normal rates. I mean, I remember, so I've been investing and involved in the market since like the late 90s. I had 10 years of experience in the industry when 2008, 2009 hit. And it was, oh, housing prices will never go down and all this stuff. And there was so much speculation there. I don't think we're in a speculative bubble with housing right now, but I do think that people have gotten a little bit lax about what they can afford. And investors too, if you think about like rental properties, you know, if someone's buying a rental property now, that demand might really cool because now they got to wait for rents to be able to go up to compensate them for that extra expense. I remember like at the CFA luncheons, all these experts, you know, we were trying to predict what interest rates would be a year from now. And everyone always said like 1 or 2% higher, we're going to have to be at 5% interest rates within the next 3 years. And they stayed low for like 12 years or 13, 14 years. I mean, they've been low since 2009. I mean, they've had some fluctuations, but now we're really seeing some significant increases, some pretty swift increases for the first time in like 15 years, which is an eternity in the financial markets.
Yeah. With other things going on with interest rates right now. So like, why are interest rates going up, Rob? Can you give us like a very basic explanation of like, let's say pre-Ukraine invasion, why were interest rates going up?
Well, it's sort of a, I mean, it's supply and demand, right? I mean, you probably know more about this than I do. I've been out of the interest rate game for a little bit, but Travis, why do you think rates are going up like this?
Jay Powell's going crazy. He's just like a drunk sailor spending on leave. I'm just kidding. Jay Powell is kind of like a Wall Street Bets Reddit board speak for Jay Powell, the chairman of the Federal Reserve. Mm-hmm. People say Jay Powell because I guess it's like when you say his name that way, you almost make it sound like you're talking about him in a meme. And I think that's kind of the attitude people have about markets right now. It's just memification of markets. But in all seriousness, so like I think that what happened, and this is a view that's sort of a mainstream view from The Economist, right? Which is sort of like a center-right publication in Europe, but sort of a center-left publication in the US from a political standpoint. Their view is that the $1.9 trillion fiscal stimulus bill that happened in 2021 ended up being too big for the moment in terms of monetary policy. Now, you might say it lowered child poverty, it did some other great things that made the economy grow, and people have talked about boomflation. And the argument sort of goes like, well, you know, inflation with a booming economy is not necessarily the worst thing ever. And there's some good arguments for that. But they're saying just in pure terms of inflation, that stimulus bill was contributory. Maybe not the only thing, but it was contributory. Another thing that was contributory is both parties plus the Fed pumping out $5 trillion of stimulus during the pandemic, plus the pandemic supply chains being so disrupted that they're still really disrupted. And so you've got consumers that have tons of money that still have not been able to spend money on experiences, traveling abroad and being a tourist to different places. And all this money has been spent on products instead of services and experiences. And so there's this huge demand for products. And then the supply chain's not strong enough to meet that demand because of things like just-in-time inventory and reasons like that. Plus, there's all these disruptions to international trade. Like there's different parts of the pandemic like sort of exploding in different regions of the world at different times, right? So you might have all these parts assembled from all over the world. And it just so happens that back when COVID started, China was shut down, which blocked all that parts of the supply chain, right? And then it was a different lockdown in a different part of the world that blocked that part of the supply chain. And so there's all these disruptions that are cascading. And so we're finally, with COVID starting to end, it all sort of caught up to us from an inflation perspective. And people just started saying, well, we're going to spend and we don't care anymore. Right. So I think that was kind of one of the big things that happened is like consumers were just unleashed and sort of just paying anything for goods and services. And so that caused interest rates to go up.
The reason that interest rates going up could be bad for the financial markets. Well, number one, it makes anyone who's seeking loans. So whether you're looking to refinance your student loans or whether you're looking to get a mortgage or get a dental practice loan, it makes the cost of those loans higher. But the other thing it does in terms of financial assets is it makes the cost of those go down. For example, with stocks, you know, stocks have been on this tear. I mean, we've had some dips, right? Like when COVID first started, it dropped 35% pretty quickly. We had some other dips. But if you look at like a 15-year chart, it's basically just been like straight up. With inflation, the good news is like a lot of companies, and we're seeing this, right? Because they just pass that extra cost of inflation onto the consumer if the consumers can handle it. So that causes prices to go up, like with beef and dairy and produce, and the grocery stores, it's not like they're eating that. They're actually just passing it along. So that makes consumers think tight. But also, companies' profit margins, typically in inflationary environments, can stay the same. They might contract a little bit, which means that companies, it won't really impact companies' earnings. But what it does impact is the valuation that people are willing to pay for those earnings. So like, let's just say you take a PE price to earnings ratio of a stock is 20 to 1, meaning for every $20 a stock is worth, you're getting a dollar in earnings. Well, if you flip that over, if you invert that fraction, it's 1 over 20, which is a 5% what's called earnings yield. So when interest rates are at 1 or 2, a 5% earnings yield is like really, really attractive because your stocks and companies are more risky. And so it makes the price you want to pay, you're willing to accept a little bit lower earnings yield. But when interest rates go up, if interest rates go up to 5%, well, then in order to get stocks, you'd want an earnings yield more in like the 8-9% range. And if you invert 8 or 9%, that's like a 12 PE on the market. So companies may still continue to do okay, but what you might see is multiple contraction, meaning that the stocks will go down because they need a lower valuation to justify the higher rates. And same thing with bonds. It's kind of similar, right?
Well, here's another math analogy for the math people out there. You know, if you've got, like, say you put $1 million in a company and you're expecting you're going to get $2 million out of that company in earnings in 10 years from now, that's a great return in a low interest rate environment. But in a high interest rate environment, you could have taken that $1 million and put it in bonds and gotten a 6% yield, and you could have gotten that for 10 years. So your interest would have earned interest as well. Right away, you get $60,000 in interest, and then the next year, $63,000 in interest, right? It's compounded interest, right? So you could get a really good return investing with very little risk if you have higher interest rates. And so then if you would get $2 million in 10 years, maybe instead of being willing to pay whatever it is you're willing to pay, like if with interest rates are higher, you're not willing to pay as much for that future profit because of what you have available to you in the economy, but putting it in bonds. And so that's really toxic. Higher interest rates are very toxic to growth companies and growth assets like Tesla, or, you know, maybe like a, maybe not Facebook as much because they've been around a little bit, but any of these kind of more speculative companies where they're expected to have the profits way off into the future, high interest rates are really bad for those kind of companies. And they tend to be good for the kind of companies like a Coca-Cola or, you know, a Walmart or a Kraft Heinz or something, you know, that's more of a consumer staples, like that, you know, there's going to be profits much sooner. Well, those stocks tend to get hit a little bit less hard with higher interest rates.
Yeah. And if you think about it, I mean, I don't know how often I've gotten the question. I'm sure you've gotten it too, but, you know, my bank account isn't paying anything right now. Where should I put my money so I can earn a higher return? Like when cash is paying you 0 or 0.5%, those questions. But if interest rates go and you say, well, you could invest it, but you need a longer time horizon, or you could put it in this bond, but it's only like 2 or 3%. But if rates go back up to 3, 4, 5% on your checking and savings account, people are going to be like, okay, I feel good about that. I might not need to take as much risk either. So they'll have a more like a different asset allocation mix in their portfolios. And like, that's why crypto and like, you know, high flying growth stocks, like you were saying, on a practical level, and all these things are like, people are just want their money to do something for them other than earn them zero. So they're just like throwing it at anything they can, NFTs, whatever the case is. And the low rates are definitely, the bubbles are a direct result of the low rates we've had for such a long period of time. People want their money to do something for them.
How dare they?
Right.
Well, let's talk about how this interest rate policy relates to student loans. Mm-hmm. So from the refinancing market, what a difficult market to be in for the past couple of years as a consumer trying to navigate this correctly. I remember back in 2020 where I was encouraging people to refinance in early March because we had this global fears of a global pandemic, which had never happened before in our lifetime. And interest rates were falling the hardest that I've ever seen. And companies were able to get capital for so cheap, turn around and lend it to consumers. I thought this was a great opportunity. It turns out I was dead wrong. They paused interest for more than 2 years on student loans. People who refinanced at that time missed out on a ton of 0% interest benefits over the following 2 years. The one positive thing that I can say is you don't know what is going to happen in the future. You have to make decisions based off of current information, based off of what's happened in the past, present and future, based off of probabilities that you can guess as good as possible, right? And people that locked in a 2.9% interest rate with a 20-year fixed rate are not going to be upset long term.
No way. Yeah.
You're going to save so much money on that rate. It's not even funny. And anyone who's worried about, oh, I missed out on 6 months of the 0% interest freeze, well, that could look tiny compared to what interest savings you will get when interest rates go up. So I wouldn't worry about anything in the past that you might have done. In terms of people that are currently benefiting from the 0% federal interest situation right now, One thing that's very strange, Rob, that I'm seeing is one or two of our lenders are doing a significant chunk of the lending right now, way more than usual. One of our lenders is doing close to like $10 million a month in volume. One of our lenders is doing like $4 million a month in volume. And then the rest of the lenders are doing like $1 million a month in volume. And that's very, very skewed. I don't know if I'm allowed to say the names of the companies, but you'll figure it out, I think, if you go to studentloanplanner.com/refi as to which one it is, because we tend to list them on the table in order of which one's converting the best. That's weird. Right now, what we're seeing is just very odd. Like, it's kind of like one company's aggressive or a couple companies are aggressive and all the other companies are backing off in the face of rising interest rates.
So you're saying that's probably a result is that they're offering rates sort of below the competition.
Yes. And so what's going on with the refinance companies right now, some of them have other sources of revenue. So they might have a bank account to sell you or an investment account or credit cards or some sort of special product for medical professionals, right? And those companies are able to take a very small margin on their student loan refinance product in the hopes that you will do other business with them. And other companies are purely refinance shops that need to make a profit on that refinance. And I think what we're seeing right now is with rising interest rates and unexpected inflation, these companies are a little bit afraid to be able to be nimble enough to make the profit they need to justify making the loan. Usually when we see like divergence like this, companies have different views of what's going on, right? So some companies think this is a blip. So other companies are kind of concerned. And if I was a consumer right now, I would be probably waiting for the next couple weeks to few weeks in March just to get a telegraph of what's the administration's position on restarting payments, because they said the last freeze was the final one and they took it back, right?
But this is the final, final one.
This is the final, final. And you know what, Rob, we'll talk about this in a second, but we could even end up having the final, final, final.
Right.
I guess I would just say, like, if you refinanced or if you're thinking about it, you just have to think about one thing. Are you going to be upset if you missed out on the rates that are around today? If you will be, then you want to hit the bid and just move on with your life and lock in a low rate and then do the refinance ladder where you're starting with a 20-year, refinancing again to a 10, then to a 5, et cetera. But if you are unsure, just wait until interest starts again. That's not the worst strategy in the world, right?
Well, the good news is that the rates are locked in for 30 days, right? So whatever quote they get now, you know, then we're getting closer to the end of March at the time we're recording this. So there'll hopefully be a little more clarity, although you never know. But then the other thing is that refinancing a mortgage, there's no closing costs. So there's actually no added, there's no like break even analysis. Like, you need to pay on this loan at this rate for this long in order to break even. People can refinance if rates go back down. But the main thing is, if someone has private loans, there's probably no need to wait. But if they have federal loans, you could, you know, maybe check it out and wait 30 days. And if, depending on what happens, you can kind of keep it going. But we are getting, don't you feel like we're getting to the 11th hour with these freezes?
Well, there was an interesting letter that Senator Warren and some of the moderate Democrats in the Senate and frontline House members sent to Biden recently about the freeze. And some people covered it as, oh, they're asking for another pause. I read that letter and this came out like last week. And I didn't read it that way. The way I read it was sort of like, we want cancellation. I mean, at this point, we're not seeing like Elizabeth Warren, Senator Warren saying on Twitter, we need another pause. We need to extend the pause again. They're not saying that. They're saying we want cancellation, right? We want to see cancellation. So it's a little bit change in the messaging. It's kind of somebody that hasn't been following this super closely might not notice it because it's a little bit of a nuanced thing. But it seems pretty clear that's what's going on. I think that there's obviously fears that they will lose, Democrats will lose one of the two chambers of Congress, which would give a little bit more barrier to enacting various things. And I think that Democrats also are very concerned about youth enthusiasm, right? You need to have your voters turn out to win elections. And if you don't fulfill this major promise that you made on the campaign trail of canceling 10,000 of student debt for all borrowers, there's some legitimate political concerns that you might have a big, important demographic group, young voters, just not turn up, really.
Do you think they can actually do that? I mean, we get questions about it all the time. You know, 10,000, that's more of an act of Congress than it would be sort of a, you know, presidential power, right?
Yeah. I mean, well, the thing what we've seen the past 2 years, Rob, is I've got to eat humble pie and realize that I really don't know that much about what's going to happen in the world. I mean, you know, I mean, but I will say this. Somebody pointed out actually email subscribers pointed out recently that the president said he would give governors 60 days notice minimum of the pause of the expiration of the emergency declaration for the pandemic. And that's right. Something that's allowing them to do things like telemedicine and having insurers reimburse higher rates and all these different flexibilities that are only allowed because there's a national emergency declaration. So that emergency declaration is also what's required to exist for Biden to do anything with student loans. He can't just do what he wants to. He's got to have some special ability to do that. Same thing with President Trump. Like, they needed to have that emergency authorization to be able to claim powers over student loans. Otherwise, the rules are set. It's in statutes based on what Congress says. And you have to go through this really long, slow regulatory process at the Department of Ed whenever you want to make a mild change, right? So some thoughts about the extension happening or not. He did extend that emergency authorization a little bit longer again because of that 60-day thing. Now, I think the main reason for that was because of those telehealth requirements and things like that. That's the reason he did it. I don't think he did it because of the student loans. But I could see him trying to do the $10,000 of cancellation next more than I would see him extending the pause. And that's kind of a bold statement. It's a little shocking to say that, but here's the problem with that statement. I also think that even if he said that there was going to be $10,000 of cancellation that he was going to authorize, I also don't think it would stand. I think that the Republicans would file a legal challenge. I think they would take it to the Supreme Court. I think that they would probably get a ruling out of the Supreme Court that says you can't do that because Congress didn't appropriate the money. So I think that there's a chance, like looking back at history, reminds me of the eviction moratorium. You know, we can recall like the eviction moratorium was expiring. President Biden said, I've got a 6-3 Supreme Court. I don't think I can, you know, they've already said that they're going to strike this down, so I'm not going to do it. And he had pressure, right, from his party to do it anyway, because that might buy some time. So that's happened in the past. And so then President Biden did that. He basically wrote an executive order that he knew would be overturned. So I could easily see some repeat of that happening potentially with the 10,000 of cancellation, even though I don't think it'll actually end up happening.
I mean, all this just freezes people with student loans from being able to make a decision. You know, you kind of have to, if interest rate, you know, do I refinance now? Do I wait? I mean, all this stuff just adds to the confusion, which I just wish to. And over the last 2 years, you know, don't get me wrong, it's been fantastic for borrowers to get some respite and kind of we can get through COVID as much as possible and get the stimulus checks out for people who've lost their jobs or who are underemployed or may not making the money that they were. But, you know, at some point it gets to be a little bit of a burden because people can't make choices or decisions on what's best for their long term. And with interest rates going up now, there's a little bit more of like an impetus to say, hey, we got to make a choice now or else we might never have such a good opportunity again. So
people have already sustained higher costs from this freeze and they benefited. Most people, not forgiveness people, not PSLF, not those people because you're getting paused payments, but people that are paying back their loans, the rate is higher now than it would have been if you'd refinanced at the end of December. And the 3 months extra of 0% interest that people got because of that is less of a benefit than if they had locked in a long-term rate, actually.
Absolutely.
We've already literally seen this past freeze cost people more money than it saved them, not because that's what they intended. It just kind of worked out that way. There's a lot of unintended consequences, right, with policymakers and student loans. Like one thing that jumped to mind recently was the studentaid.gov is transitioning away from all the servicer websites to a single website through studentaid.gov. That's one of the big things they have planned. Well, what's the problem with that? If I'm a servicer that operates on a fixed fee contract and I hear that you're going to be dumping my website anyway and you're going to be putting it onto the federal website, should I be investing in my own website as a servicer in the 1 year that it takes them to stand this website up? Or should I be ignoring my website completely, letting people complain all they want to the CFPB and not giving a you know what?
I think we're going to see a flurry of the best looking federal student loan servicer websites in the history of federal student loan servicing.
Somebody sent me a message last week and they were like, hey, Travis, this AidVantage website makes me wish I had Navy back in my life. That's how bad it is. I mean, so it kind of makes sense. It's like you took over the servicing and, you know, again, like how much are you going to spend on the website if you know it's going to be axed after a year anyway? And so that's kind of an example of even people who are borrower advocates who are trying to help out borrowers do things in such a way that sometimes results in borrowers getting hurt. We're seeing all these weird situations with the PSLF waiver, just really bizarre stuff where some people that were trying to be responsible who paid off one of their small loans that had a high interest rate could have consolidated the whole thing and had the whole thing forgiven, but they paid off one of those loans and then now it's too late. I mean, just bizarre stuff. And another strategy is throw as much gum in the woodwork, so to speak, to slow down the repayment process, to try to help borrowers pay less and try to build momentum towards canceling loans. Like, that's an understandable strategy. Where I get concerned for what we do, helping student loan borrowers, is that that causes unintended consequences, where borrowers believe, because of all the things they've heard in the media, that student loans never will start again, or that they never will have to pay back their debt, or, you know, that 10,000 or 50,000 cancellation is a sure thing, and they just have to wait around long enough for it to happen. So those are the things that kind of get me concerned.
Yeah. I mean, I had a consult recently with somebody who, they were wondering how they could get this forgiveness that's coming down the pike. That was one of their questions in the Q&A section. Yeah. And I was like, well, what do you, you know, which one are you referring to? Are you referring to the PSLF waiver? Cause you're not, you don't have employment for that. They're like, no, like the loan forgiveness. All my friends are talking about how there's loan forgiveness coming down the pike for everybody.
Yeah.
And I said, I mean, it's possible, but highly unlikely. So we get questions like this all the time, but it sounds like what you're saying is the 10,000 forgiveness has a very low probability. So I guess, like, to make people's decisions easier on whether they should refinance now or later, or like what rates are going to do, if we just kind of say, you kind of have to do the expected return, right? So if the $10,000 loan forgiveness is a low probability, it shouldn't be a deciding factor. But what people have been doing is they've been saying, well, my rate's zero now with the pause, and why would I want to refinance to a 3% rate? But now maybe they have to flip the mindset to say, well, my grad plus loans are 6.8%. I think I should consider refinancing them down to 4 or 3.5.
Yeah. We don't have a crystal ball here.
Right.
We don't know what's going to happen.
I thought you had one over there.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to see if the president does anything in the State of the Union address that we need to react to, because that's coming up very shortly. There's some interesting controversy about that. Like, supposedly one of the members of the progressive wing of the House caucus is doing a response to the president, kind of like how the opposition party usually does that. And I don't know, I follow a lot of different things online. And I think one comedian said something like, why would you do that? That's like an offensive tackle that sacks his own quarterback. <You know? laughs> And it was kind of an amusing comment, I guess. But they're calling in that address, the progressive kind of address, they're calling for cancellation of student debt. Is that something that works? Or is that something that kind of backfires politically, right? Where, you know, there's definitely some criticism right now of the progressive wing about, you know, electoral liabilities that the party is concerned about, just because of some of the sort of effect, I guess, on some of the more moderate members with some of the attack ads that are made against them.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, people who have student loans, especially our clients who have six-figure student debt, it's a real burden. But at the same time, 2/3 of the U.S. population doesn't have a college degree and never went to college, doesn't have student loans. So you got to balance what's going to be best for the overall. But I mean, I think what they've been doing with targeted loan forgiveness has been great. Like, for example, people who are in Social Security disability and saying, forget about having them have to file this form and send it off. Like, let's just reconcile the student loan database with the Social Security disability database and let's just give them loan forgiveness. That's in the rules. They're supposed to get it anyway. They've been trying to do that as best as they can. But I don't know. I think all this stuff just adds confusion.
I do appreciate the work that the people at the Department of Ed are doing. I do want to say, like, I think they're trying hard to do a great job, and I do appreciate the constraints that they're operating under, because I'm sure they would have designed the programs very differently, except that there's a lot of statutes and things they have to work around in order to do the kind of relief that they're trying to do. So I want to say that I recognize that. And also, Congress is the one that sets how much they're going to pay the loan servicers. So, you know, Department of Ed can't just go say, all right, we're going to pay you twice as much, but we're going to have, you know, 10 times as high expectations. They can't do that because Congress is the one that sets all the rules for that kind of thing, I think. So right. What I'm going to be watching, Rob, is like last time, December 22nd or 23rd is when they extended the pause, which was about 40 days before the restart of payments. So as we sit here, we're about 60 days away from the restart of payments. Basically, within 20 days, we should have a pretty clear indication either way. Certainly by, like, I don't want to say April Fool's Day, but, like, you know, probably by that point in April, right, it's going to be pretty clear what's going to happen. And we don't have any sort of big events that are waiting to fall like we did last time. Like last time we had Build Back Better, which was this big momentum behind that, and tons of the media, like I guess Oxygen, was consumed by the discussion of that bill. Mm-hmm. And then when that failed, it was so deflating to, you know, especially the progressive members of the president's party, that everybody needed a win. Everybody mm-hmm. needed a quick win from a policy and political standpoint because of just the frustration around that. And the student loan interest pause was just this very low hanging fruit that you could just say, all right, let's go do this, you know?
Right.
So I don't know if we had that this time. Like, I will say that with the midterms being so close to the expiration, that's concerning. Like, that's a little bit of a concern, where if I was a Democratic politician, I would certainly think about extending it. Mm-hmm. Because if I've got that emergency declaration that's extended a little bit longer, I have the power to. Nobody can say I don't. That's something that we will be monitoring, of course, very closely.
Yeah. I guess we'll see what happens there, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe let's skip back to rates a little bit and that discussion. I mean, what do you think about, I mean, I just said before how it's hard to prognosticate interest rates and inflation, but what are just your general thoughts about where we go from here?
Well, this Ukraine invasion situation is just a pure wild card. I mean, looking at rates, it was going up to like 2.1% for the 10-year treasury, and it was just inflation pressure was building and building and building. And then we had this Russian invasion, and mm-hmm. it just came out of nowhere. Everybody kind of assumed, I think, that it was going to be intense brinksmanship and just a bunch of bluster. And, you know, maybe the Russians would sort of cross over into, you know, Luhansk and Donetsk and just sort of actually formally position Russian troops there. Everybody, I think, kind of thought that. And now we have this just spiraling situation. And we certainly hope and pray that there's peace results as soon as possible.
Absolutely.
But this is a chaotic situation. And it is a low probability of a dangerous situation, but it is a dangerous situation because you've got this evil dictator who has his hand on the trigger. Somebody said something on Twitter the other day that was like, there's not that big of a gap between Vladimir Putin is humiliated and the end of the world as we know it. Mm-hmm. Which I thought was kind of a gut punch to think about that. So I guess, like, with interest rates, where do we go from here? Well, interest rates are falling again. So now I looked today, they're down like 1.8% as we're recording this near beginning of March. If the situation continues to spiral, like, does it, you know, do 10-year treasuries get really low down to like 1.5% again? And then all of a sudden mortgages are back low again and the Fed raises interest rates, but maybe a little bit less than they were planning on. I think that that's probably the big question mark. I don't know. My guess is just they do a little bit fewer rate hikes than they were planning on, just because of the whole situation with the global economy being kind of scared about this whole situation with Russia. But, you know, I think what will happen, Rob, is if there's a solution on this, or if there's a resolution on this, either way, I think that you'll start seeing things get back to what they were, and interest rates will continue being, you know, very highly pressured.
Yeah, a little bit of a highly pressure to the upside or the downside?
Upside, to the upside. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I look at the rates and inflation as, like, the situation in Ukraine, I mean, it's awful. And we'll have a short-term, like, events have a short-term impact on interest rates. But over the long run, there's kind of like, you know, you got to look at, like, the long-run view. Let's just say a year or two from now, this conflict is over. Hopefully it resolves itself the best way possible. What are the structural signs that lead toward inflation, toward higher interest rates look like? I mean, obviously, interest rates have been kept low for a number of different reasons. Like, when the housing bubble burst, they had to stimulate borrowing and home buying again. And then, you know, then where we're at now, we've got inflation. So they've, you know, things have gotten like really hot. And now the GDP and the economy is growing quickly, which means that typically inflation will go in and then they'll have to raise rates. So I do think that rates will start to go a little bit higher. I don't think we're going to have like a super hyperinflationary, long-term hyperinflationary period. Obviously, everyone's seeing it, you know, the 7.5% inflation over the last 12 months, specifically for shelter, food, and gas. And the gas, it kind of fluctuates based upon, like, the Ukraine-Russian conflict, that definitely caused oil to go over $100 a barrel. But at the same time, that could be just like a blip. I would say in the long run, I think rates might settle in at a higher rate than where they are today. But it's not going to be like the late 70s, early 80s, where we had like double-digit inflation and stuff like that. I don't see that happening.
Well, you could see a situation where you have a recap of what happened earlier this year, which is that interest rates are really low, but inflation was really bad.
Yeah.
You could see a situation where you have gas prices be really high, like you have bad energy inflation that causes interest rates to stay low because of the global geopolitical situation, but prices continue their upward climb because of all these, you know, commodity pressures on, you know, prices being much higher. So anything can happen. We're throwing out so much heavy stuff here, Rob. I'm going to try to give a little bit of a humorous take here. I actually went to the ER this past weekend. I was walking in my house, sprinting to get my baby's blanket because we had just put her down and I left it downstairs. So I was running to get the blanket and the supply chain, right? So we're waiting on getting our hardwood floors to be finished because of not having the right color or something like that, whatever that my wife was looking for. And so these floors are still 40 years old, kind of rough. So anyways, I'm running to get the blanket and a piece of the floor breaks off and goes all the way through my foot.
Holy cow.
And embeds into it.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I'm just on the floor, just in so much pain, yelling. My wife, being a surgeon, comes down with some stuff and tries to get it out. And she goes, "Oh, wow, I can't get this out."
Oh, my goodness.
And I was like, "What?" And so we go to the hospital and they had to do a procedure to cut my foot open and get it out. And I've been walking with a cane for like the past week. So you might say, well, how the heck is this related to interest rates? That's a great question. The thing is unexpected things happen in life. You cannot control sometimes the random, unexpected, just terrible things that happen. But what you can control is having, you know, a good foundation and doing long-term responsible things. For example, I'm trying to take my antibiotics. Luckily, we had the right kind of health insurance in place. We had resources to be able to afford a cane or, you know, to something to help me so I could take weight off of my foot. And luckily I had a job where I had the flexibility to sit in a chair and record this podcast instead of stand up. That's kind of how you make sense of all this. All this interest rate chaos, all this geopolitical chaos, the 1% chance that we're close to the end of the world because of nuclear arms and everything. I mean, there's so much to worry about. You can't let yourself worry about all that. What you can do is focus on what you can control, which is doing things like knowing what you're doing with your student loans, you know, having that long-term plan, having the right kinds of insurances in place, having the right emergency fund in place, the right spending plan in place, right? So just if you could give a little bit quick of like a 30-second sort of synopsis, Rob, of like what the booking situation is for the consults right now and what you kind of suggest to somebody who's hoping to get a plan before June, what they should do.
Yeah, well, first, let me say, you said this was going to be on a lighter note, and you talk about how you had to go into emergency surgery for your foot, and you're on antibiotics, and you can't walk. So I don't know about that, but I like the message that you're talking about with one of gratitude and thinking about your situation.
Well, I can walk, just not great.
Well, I hope you have a speedy recovery, and
thanks.
I'm glad you're married to Christine and that she helped steer you in the right direction and took care of you a little bit too. But yeah, I mean, we're like really getting booked up. I think I'm booked up, me personally, like I'm booked up the next 4 or 5 weeks. And we brought on 2 new consultants who are going to open up our availability. But, you know, I think with people seeing the student loan pause coming, you know, a lot of people, they just wait to the last minute, and that's totally fine, right? I always tell people it's never too early, but it's also never too late. So whenever you can get in there and get a clear plan in place, if payments start back up and you haven't had a chance to get a clear plan in place, there's still plenty of time to book one. And maybe you have a month of payments or 2 months of payments, but it's not going to, what's going to be the more important outcome is to get on the optimal student loan plan for you going forward.
Yeah. I mean, I've kept prices where they are for the team, like intentionally with the theory that it's better for people to wait a month and get the same pricing than to raise prices 20% and then have more availability. And also, it's also about quality control, where I could probably add, somebody's like, why don't you add 5 more consultants? And it's like, because I want each one to be incredible. And I want to make sure each one does a really amazing job. And that takes time.
For sure.
I kind of feel like we're in like the luxury cabinet making business, Rob. And like you and the team are just like some of the best out there. And I could, you know, bring in somebody and just be like, oh, this is how you put together a cabinet, just to get some orders finished, right? But I don't know. No, I'm just being silly at this point.
Yeah, I always joke around with you. It's like, the caliber of the people that we brought on, since I was like basically the first other consultant aside from you, like I guess 4.5 years ago or whatever. And there's no way that if I came to you with what I knew before we started working together, that I would even be considered for a position as a consultant. But now you trained me over a 6-month period back then. And like, I've done over 1,000 consults and almost $300 million of student debt just on my own. So like, I know what I'm doing now, but the people that are coming here, like, all the consultant team, I mean, they're just so all totally, totally incredible. And I think the fact that you have taken your time to hire right has high quality people, high knowledgeable people, people who care. I mean, these people really care about getting people getting people with student loans the best results possible.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, like, because there's probably somebody listening to this that's going to be graduating in May or going to be finishing training in May or June. And I just wanted to say that if you wanted to plan around that time, you need to schedule it now, because you can book up to like 90 days in advance, I believe is what we're letting people do, because just the calendar is so crazy. So studentloanplanner.com/book. And you can also do that for follow-up plans as well. If you need a follow-up plan, you can use that same link now to schedule a call. So one final announcement, Rob, we've actually got a new service that we're doing. We've got SLP insurance that we now have in almost all states. We're in the process of getting it set up. If you want to get a quote for own occupation disability and or term life insurance, you can go to studentloanplanner.com/insurance. So there's going to be a lot more about that, a lot more about why I decided to launch that business. But I just thought I'd mention it because a whole lot of people start finishing training. They get their match happens in March, right, for physicians. You know, people start figuring out like what job they're going to be doing next. And so I just thought I'd mention that, you know, we can help people with that, getting quotes for that, making sure you have the foundation right.
Yeah, it's really important, especially for the graduate level professionals that we work with, you know, especially in the medical and healthcare field that work with their hands and maybe have six-figure income coming out of graduate school. That protection is really important. I mean, I'm not, obviously, you know, we're not selling whole life insurance or anything like that. It's term life. This has been something that I know we've had a lot of discussions about, and it's completely additive and complementary to the advice that we're already giving.
Yeah, and the agent that we're working with for SLP insurance for this that we added to the team, I sent him a picture of the speared foot, to joke around. And he said, that's pretty bad. He said, Travis, you're totally uninsurable now. So I thought that was kind of funny.
The question is weird. Are you still going to be able to play basketball though? That's the question.
I will, but I'm going to have to take a little bit of a break. And, you know, it's kind of hard to put pressure. And they also had to like not stitch it because they needed to be open to prevent infection or something. I don't know.
You have to clean it from the inside or irrigate it or whatever.
Yeah. I'm not a doctor. I don't want to, this is a family friendly podcast, Rob. I already said too much, but
wounds and stuff.
I know. studentloanplanner.com/insurance so that your family doesn't have to be out on the street when you have a splinter pierce your foot.
For sure. If I could just say one final thing, there's a lot of uncertainty in the world. There's a lot of uncertainty with interest rates, but like Travis said, I think the most important thing is that you get clear on your specific situation. And the best way you can do that is by checking out the resources on our website, by booking a consult. And the only thing you control are the things within your power, like your ability to save money, the individual decisions that you make. And I think one of the best outcomes that happens from our consults is not only the savings of the dollars, but it's just the clarity and feeling like, okay, now I know for sure after talking with an expert that I'm on the right path. So take control of what you can take control of. Hopefully you all are thankful for the things that you have in your life that others may not have, even though life isn't perfect. And let's leave with that positive message that we all are in charge of our own lives.
Well, thank you, Rob. And thank you everyone for listening to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast.